From New York, this is Democracy Now!
First of all, we were taken as held for ransom. Then I was sold to the CIA as Al-Qaeda general, middle-aged Egyptian, you know, a line of insider. I was taken to the black site, where I was like tortured for over 2 months. Then from the black site to Kandahar detention.
Today, a Democracy Now! Special. We spend the hour with Mansour Adaifi. He was imprisoned at Guantanamo for over 14 years after being sold as a teenager to the CIA by an Afghan warlord after the 9/11 attacks. By the time he was released, he'd spent half his life in U.S. custody, but was never charged with a crime. He'll talk about being tortured and why he repeatedly went on hunger strike to protest inhumane conditions.
We were hurting ourselves. I always tell the people, you know, our bodies was the battlefield because Americans torture us, abuse us, and beat us. And in our bodies, also, we were torturing our bodies by hunger strike, by trying to resist. And I wrote about it, the hunger strike. It was a slow journey to death, toward death. That's hunger strike.
Mansour Adaifi will talk about his new memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo, and how art helped him and others survive Guantanamo.
Art connects us to the world outside. You can see the brothers, we paint, see trees. The things we missed most, sky, the stars, you know, homes, deserts, and so on.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a Democracy Now! Special. We spend the hour with Mansour Adaifi. At the age of 18, he left his home in Yemen to do research in Afghanistan. Shortly before he was scheduled to return home, he was kidnapped by Afghan warlords and sold to the CIA for a bounty after the September 11th attacks. He was jailed and tortured in Afghanistan, then transported to the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo in 2002, where he was held without charge for 14 years, many of those years in solitary confinement. Mansour became known as Detainee 441. In 2016, he was released against his will to Serbia, which he compares to Guantanamo 2.0. By the time Mansour was released, he'd spent more than half of his life locked up. Mansour Adaifi has just published his memoir. It's called Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. I spoke to him in September from his home in Belgrade. I began by asking him to talk about how he ended up at Guantanamo.
Okay, let's fly back 38 years, which actually when people ask me how old are you, I said 24 because I didn't count Guantanamo, tried to cheat. Anyway, I born in a tiny village in Yemen, Raima. Born with 11 brothers and sisters, large family, very conservative family. Until I studied my primary school and secondary school in the village, we had no high school, so I had to go and live with my aunt in the capital Sana'a, which new world. When I finished with my high school, I was assigned to do some research in Afghanistan. I was a research assistant in Afghanistan. This is how my journey started there. In Afghanistan, I spent a couple of months researching and doing some of the research required to be done. One day after 9/11, I was kidnapped by the warlord. They were actually interested in the car. They weren't interested in us. Then when American came, the American airplane, they were throwing a lot of flyers offering a large bounty of money. Could it change Afghani's life? So Afghanis found out that the more you give them high-ranked people, the more you get paid. The price ranged between $5,000 to $200,000, $500,000. First of all, we were taken as held for ransom. Then I was sold to the CIA as Al-Qaeda general, middle-aged Egyptian, you know, nine of an insider was taken to the black site, where it was like tortured for like over 2 months. Then from the black site to Kandahar detention was one of the funny things. When I arrived at Kandahar detention, I was throwing naked there. It's like another, it's a long journey. Second day of my arrival, guards came to move me to a tent. After the interrogation, I was asked to sign a paper that the Americans have a right to shoot me and kill me if I try to escape. I said, no, I'm not going to sign. Of course, I will try to escape. I shouldn't be in the first place. So yeah, I was beating. I refused to sign. They put my hand on the paper. They signed it themselves. I said, no, that doesn't count. I have to sign with my, like, willingly.
And when you talked about a bounty being paid to the warlords who handed you over to the U.S. CIA, and then you were tortured at a black site, do you know where that black site was? And when you say tortured, what actually happened to you in that two-month period? If I hate to bring you back there, but what actually happened?
You know, I didn't know where until that day. I don't know where the black site is, where that place. But I was kept before that at one of the warlord home. I was treated like a guest, teaching his kids classes, math, Quran, and so on. And after that, I was when American came, they stripped naked, they put me in the bag, hooded, and they shipped me to somewhere. I don't know. Until that day, so. And the black site, it was one of the worst experiences in my life. Sometimes I afraid to get back there, not because fear, it's just, to relive that trauma, because there was no limit to whatever they can do to us, 24 hours.
And these were U.S. soldiers?
Yes, U.S. soldiers, and with also Afghanis, where people actually lost their life there, because they were looking for where Osama bin Laden, where is Mullah Muhammad Umar, where the new attacks, the sleeper cells. And they have a long list and photos and all kind of things. So, yes, I mean, those black sites, I believe no one knows how many people ended there and how many people actually died there. But there was no limitation to whatever they can do to you. I mean, we've been hang on the ceiling all the time, upside down. Even if we are blindfolded, naked, the food, the drink, they just pour rice and water in our mouth. Sometimes we also do our things while standing, and there is no rest. 24 hours is a programming, like sleep deprivation. We have only sleep, they give you 30 minutes, like then 6 hours, then 20 minutes if you can sleep. Loud music, beating, waterboarding. They used to put us in kind of like a barrel and roll it in the ice and shoe. And the first time I did, I thought that I died because they rolled it and they used to they shot with the gun. I like was looking with the holes, but I was still alive. So, yes, I mean.
And so you were taken from there to Kandahar, and then you were held where in Kandahar before being brought to Guantanamo?
I think in Kandahar, we were at the airport. They have a detention. They built a detention prison in Kandahar. It was tents surrounded with like high walls of barbed wires. We could see the airplanes taken off and every time. So When we used to see the small airplanes, we knew they bring a new group of people. But we called the big one, we called the Beast, the Air Force, really big one. So that when it came, we all like panicked because we knew some people was going to leave and they're going to disappear. So even that trauma, just waiting for your name to or number to be, no name, to be our name to be called, they took us and they called a process station where they just dragged me to that place, hang on the pool, stripped naked, shaved, and they were all kind of humiliation. I mean, just too much to talk about it. So when we were packed on orange jumpsuit, everything was orange. Shoes, socks, uniform, shirt, T-shirt, pants, Everything was orange. And they have also goggles, earmuffs. My mouth was duct taped. My eyes, too. Also then hood. And they bought one more thing about special because as big fish, they bought a sign around my neck, which said, beat me. So every 10 minutes, I get beaten all the way for the next over 40 hours until we arrived at Guantanamo.
And what did they say you did? What were the charges against you?
You know, at the black side, I was accused to be an Egyptian. They asked me I was in Nairobi and was recruiting, money laundering. I was Al-Qaeda camp, head of the camp, trainer, commander, all kind of accusation. I tried to deny them, but I admit to everything, you know. But the problem was with the details. I couldn't give them the details. By the end of like 2 months and a half, when they found that I wasn't that person, they just threw me in Kandahar detention. And from Kandahar, the same file were sent with me when the interrogation started again about the same person. And in Guantanamo over and over and over again.
Now, I want to just be very clear. You were 18 years old.
Yeah, I was 18 years old when I was kidnapped. I turned 19 on the black side.
So your time at Guantanamo, Mansoor. First of all, your English is excellent. Where did you learn English? Did you speak English in Kandahar? Did you learn English in the black site and when you were being tortured and then at Guantanamo for the more than decade that you were held there?
In the black site and Kandahar, all I learned how to stay alive. You know, that's it. You know, just try to survive, try to stay, to hold to little hope I had that place. But I learned, you know, in Yemen in school, we studied English, but very basic. Also, before Guantanamo, I worked in Yemen in a security company. I used to work in German embassy, in Dutch embassy. So, but my English was very, very basic. And the black side even made me forget my name and my family and everything. When I arrived at Guantanamo, I started learning English in 2010. When we moved from the dark age to the golden age, when the White House became the Black House. Sorry, guys, that's what you call it. So I learned my best learning in Guantanamo and after 2010, and we also found a businessman there. We had a class with one of the brothers who lived in the United States for 17 years. He taught us English and business. And we prepared some feasibility report, Yemen Milk and Honey. It's a business plan. I'll send you guys photos.
When did you start writing Don't Forget Us Here, your story, your life in Guantanamo, the subtitle Lost and Found at Guantanamo?
You know, before that, I lived it minute, second by second, moment by moment, breath by breath. That's what I did. Secondly, after 2010, in 2009, I was assigned for the first time for a lawyer, Andy Hart. He was my friend. He died in 2013, one of the good people I lost at Guantanamo. Anyway, I started writing Arabic letter as stories to Andy Hart, and he loved it. And he encouraged me. But I also, when I started learning English, I used to write in Arabic, then translate into English, which took me a long time. So one of the funny stories, when I started learning English, I had a book called Around the World in 80 Days. It's like Arabic English. I used to read with the guard, hey, MP, can you please help me in learning English? I would read half page and go. We had only one dictionary in the block and go to check for the words. And I spent 6 months to finish the book. So the guards and brothers used to make fun of me. They said, Mansoor, have you finished your trip? That guy finished in 86 days. In 80 days, I said, no, I haven't found my sweetheart yet. When I found her, the trip will finish. So one of the guards, nice guards, he saw me. I didn't have a dictionary. He bought me the first dictionary as a gift was Webster. So I started also helping me to learn. I wrote the first draft from 2010 until 2013. But in 2013, when the camp administration locked down the camp, and they canceled the community living. They confiscated everything. Actually, they reset it. Guantanamo. We went back to the even the old, worse than the camp. Actually, everything was taken. We were stripped naked, both our jumpsuit, and they took our books, our letters, our artwork, everything. They took my drafts. I have two drafts, other book too, documentary. I was screaming, "Bring my baby! I need my child!" So they refused to get it back. Then
this
again,
is during this is under President Obama.
Yeah. It is, we call it the golden age during Obama because, as you know, Obama signed an executive order to close Guantanamo in 2009. But deep inside me, I wanted to believe, but I had the feeling it's not going to happen. When they found out Guantanamo is not going to be closed, they relaxed the rules. They didn't change the rules. You know, they're American, very smart, you know. I was on force feeding for 3 years, and there was many of us. So we negotiated a deal with the CADM administration to improve the life, healthcare. We asked for classes, art class, English class, TVs, better food, better healthcare, phone calls with our families. Actually, almost like most of our demands were met. But that trick, they wanted to calm us down. It's not because they want to improve things. So during that time, we had a little peace. I started write my memoir. But again, in 2013, when the army came, they closed the communal living again. They took everything because they weren't happy about how we lived. In 2015, I get a lovely lawyer, Aunt Beth Jacob. When I met her, I used to go to the classroom while chained and shackled to the floor. I start writing again my memoir, but that time in English and the cursive writing. Every week, I would write like 20 pages, 25 pages, and send them to her as legal mail. She collected all the letters, and again, she because all the letters have to go to the secure facility in Washington. She collected all the letters and send them back to Guantanamo, where they get to be screened and read again. And the book was the draft was approved.
Former Guantanamo prisoner Mansour Daifi, he's author of the memoir Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. When we come back, Mansour will talk about how he survived the prison and why he repeatedly went on hunger strike.
في رضاك بغية العليل منية الكليل أن يراك
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're continuing our conversation with Mansour Daifi, imprisoned by the United States at Guantanamo for 14 years, author of the new memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo.
Most people don't know about the purpose of Guantanamo. Let me talk just a little. Guantanamo, as you know, it was outside of the law. They call it the island outside of the law. So the purpose of Guantanamo wasn't about making Americans safe or about safety or security. It wasn't that purpose. So we were called detainees, and as you know, international law doesn't apply. Not Geneva Convention doesn't apply. American law doesn't apply. Cuba law doesn't apply. Nothing applies at that place. It's just a dark hole, a black site within the military base. So when General Miller arrived in 2000, by the end of 2002, he's the first one who wrote the CAMP SOP, Standard Operation Procedure, and he was the first one who started developing what they call enhanced interrogation technique, enhanced torture technique. So we were kept in solitary confinement, experimented on, punished. Everything utilized as experiment, our religion, our daily life, food, clothes, medicine, talk, air, everything was used in those experiments. Also, there was a psychologist who supervised those experiments. You know, there was around, as you know, around 800 detainees from 50 nationalities, 20 languages spoken. But, you know, Amy, the youngest detainee was only 3 months old. They brought him with his father. He was kept in the hospital. The oldest detainee was 105 years old. That man was my neighbor. And that what hurt me most at Guantanamo, seeing that man at that age treated like the same I was treated, I couldn't take it. I had to fight every day with the guard to stop treating that way. So, yes, General Miral was his job. There is a research called Guantanamo's America's Battle Lab. Talk about how Guantanamo was turned into an experimenting lab on detainees. So even not just us. There was a chaplain, I think you know about James Yee. I met him at Guantanamo.
James Yee was the chaplain at Guantanamo who would come out and talk about what happened there.
No, before what happened to James Yee at Guantanamo shocked and surprised us all. I remember the first time I talked to James Yee, I was taken to the interrogation room, stripped naked, and they put me in a call it a satanic room, where they have like stars, signs, candles, and crazy guy come in like white, crazy clothes, reciting something. So they also used to throw the Holy Quran on the ground, and, you know, they tried to pressure us to, you know, like, they were experimenting, basically. When I met James Yee, I told him, look, that would happen with us that way. James Yee tried to, he was protesting against the torture at Guantanamo. General Miller, the one who was actually developing enhanced interrogation technique, enhanced torture technique, so that James Yee as a chaplain is going to be a problem. So he was accused as sympathized with terrorists. He was arrested, detained, and interrogated. This is American Army captain, a graduate of West Point University, came to serve at Guantanamo to serve his own country, was because a Muslim background, he was accused and of terrorism and was, you know, detained and imprisoned. This is this American guy. Imagine what would happen to us at that place. So when they took James Yee, we protested. We asked to brought them back because the lawyers told us what happened for him after like 1 year. We wrote letter to the Camp administration, to the White House, to the Security Council, to the United Nations, to everyone, basically.
When you talked about General Miller, just for people who might not remember, he oversaw the enhanced interrogation techniques. That was the euphemism for torture at Guantanamo. Then brought from there to Iraq to Gitmoize Abu Ghraib there, to bring those same torture techniques there. And when the Taguba report came out, it cited Miller for the massive level of abuse at Abu Ghraib. So in that period, I mean, Mansour Daifi, you write so powerfully about what sustained you, about the relationships you had, not only with other prisoners, or as you say, detainees, but with guards as well. Can you talk about that?
You know, Amy, let me go a little like, I'd like to make a point here. First of all, we, as prisoners, or we were not just the victims of Guantanamo. There are also guards and camp staff were also victims of Guantanamo itself. You know, that war situation or condition brought us together and proved that we all human and we share the same humanity first. Also, Amy, a simple question. What makes a human as a human? Make Amy as Amy, make Mansour as Mansour, makes the guys in the as individual and person, you know? What makes you as a human and uniquely is your name, your language, your faith, your morals, your ethics, your memories, your relationship, your knowledge, your experience, basically your family. That's what makes a person as a person. At Guantanamo, when we arrived there, imagine the system was designed to strip us of who we are. You know, even our names was taken or become numbers. You're not allowed to practice religion. You're not allowed to talk. You're not allowed to have a relationship. So to the extent we thought, if they were able to control our thought, they would have done it. So when you arrive at Guantanamo, one of the things people still don't know about Guantanamo, we had no shared life before Guantanamo. Everything was different, was new, and unknown, and a scary unknown, you know? So we started developing some kind of relationship with each other at Guantanamo, between among us like prisoners or brothers, and with the guards too, because when guards came to work at Guantanamo, they became part of our life, part of our memories that will never go away. The same thing. We become part of their life, become memories. Before the guards arrived at Guantanamo, they were told, some of them were taken to the Nail of Insight, Ground Zero, and they were told the one who had done this is in Guantanamo. Imagine when they arrived at Guantanamo, they came with a lot of hate and grudge and revenge. But when they live with us and watch us every day, eat, drink, sleep, get beaten, get sick, screaming, yelling, interrogated, torture. You know, also they are humans. You know, the camp administration, they cannot lie them forever. So the guards also, when they live with us, they found out they're not the men we were told they're about. Some of them, you know, were apologizing to us. Some of them, we form strong friendship with them. Some of them convert to Islam. So I remember one of the female guards. We had a younger brother. He was only 15 years old. You know, he was looked scary all the time. This during 2003 and 4, the worst times, torture. She always would bring chocolate for him and told him, listen, everything is going to be okay. I have a brother at your age. Every time she came to work in the block, you know, I will never forget that moment, because even those guards, they are still humans, and they also were victims of Guantanamo machinery. I remember one of the days when I refused to, as protest, to walk to the interrogation room. So they used to bring the FCE teams, force extraction teams or riot teams. They would spray us, bring the dogs first, then pepper spray, then kick our asses, then drag us on our back to the interrogation room. The escort was a female. She was ordered to drag me. She said no. And the watch commander told her, drag the detainee. She said, no. They called the camp officer. When he came, he said, drag the fucking detainee. She said, I cannot do it. And he told her, step aside. The other guard come to drag me. I told her, okay, you can do it. I don't care. I didn't want her to get in trouble. But so I was, when they dragged me, I was like, beep, beep. They came in my back. So she was forced to watch. I mean, not just as sometime, Amy, we used to fight for the guards, you know, especially when they came in living, the guards would stay outside in the heat. They didn't have tents. We have to write letters to the colonel. Sometimes we have to protest in many occasions because the rule, the military rules is cruel, and they treat those guards as a product, not humans. You know, even those guards, when they, some of them went to tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. When they come back, we saw how they changed. When I grew up, I became my 30s. When they used to bring younger guards, I looked them as like younger brothers and sisters, and always tell them like, "Please get out of the military because it's going to devastate you." I have seen many people change.
I mean, this is such an important point you're making. You were there when you were 19, and you were still there in your 30s. And then the young people who are there, who are the guards, are the age you were when you first got there.
Yeah, I mean, because I have, when I grew up at that place, when I saw how the guards came back, many of them were mentally devastated. You know, when you see a broken soul, it is painful than anything. You know, even the pain that touched your soul, it is worse than, it is the most severe pain. I have experienced many pain, beating, torture, even you name it. But the worst thing I experienced, then that touched my soul.
I wanted to ask you about the hunger strikes. You participated in these for years, and you were force-fed.
You know, I mean, we were in a place, we tried to survive. As I told you, we had only each other. And there is no way, we tried to stop the torture, the abuses, the mistreatment. You know, we tried to find why we were held there, till when I was going to happen to us. So when the first time when I come the X-ray, when they were harsh, stopping us from praying together. One day they came, one of the brothers were praying. They opened his door, they beat him, and they threw the holy book into the floor. So we, you know, this is the first protest together. So we discussed among ourselves, what should we do, you know? Okay, the first time I heard about the hunger strike, I never heard about it before, we went on hunger strike. It was, I spent 9 days. It was a mean try to survive. I mean, we were hurting ourselves. I always tell the people, you know, our bodies was the battlefield because Americans torture us, abuse us, and beat us. And in our bodies, also we were torturing our bodies by hunger strike, by try to resist. And I wrote about it, the hunger strike. It was a slow journey to death, toward death. That's hunger strike, you know. They also become very experienced how to break the hunger strike. We spent almost every year we had like to go through many hunger strikes over and over and over and over again. We force fed in 2005, 7, 2010, 13. Some of the brothers spent 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. There are brothers still until now on force feeding until that day.
And what was that force feeding? Can you describe it? I mean, we're just learning. We were just learning about what was happening at Guantanamo at the time, the tubes that were used, how big they were, that this was used as a form of torture as well, what it meant when they were forced to stop force feeding you.
You know, like, as I told you, they were also, the doctors, they were experimenting on us. They used to bring, they tried to bring the hunger strike. I was one of the very first five detainees who was on the brink of death in 2005, before they approved the force feeding. I remember when the camp commander came, he said, now the Congress, approved the force feeding. When they took us, they bring tubes, they took through our nose. Our nose is like a drill. Bleeding
through your nose.
So and they, through our noses to our stomach. And we at that time we were in bed, you know. Then the situation got worse. They brought something called force feeding a chair, which like they tie our heads, 8 points, our shoulders, our wrist, our waist, our legs, and they're force feeding a chair. Then. They brought also really large, they call it nine French tube, really large, and they put it through our nose. We were screaming, shouting that, eat. No, wait, eat. In 2005, they forced all of us to stop the hunger strike. What they did, they used to feed us. Regularly, they should for us twice a day. But when they wanted to bring the hunger strike, they used to feed us five times a day. Nobody can last. They used to bring piles of insure and just pull in our stomach one after another. We threw up. It doesn't matter. Eat 8 hours to 12 hours in the force feeding chair.
This is they used to bring insure through your nose.
Yes, they used to pour the insure one can after we was to throw up. If you throw up, you get more. They also used to bring some laxative in the insure we. And ourselves on the feeding chair. And we were taken to a certain confinement, really cold AC. They said, I remember that time there's a general who came, he said, I was sent by the White House just to bring, to break your hunger strike. The first time he met me, he said, he took my file. Sir, 441, he's so mean, like you can say in his eyes, in words, he said, I'm here today to tell you, sir, eat, because tomorrow there will be no talking. I tried to explain to him that why you are in a hunger strike. He said like, I don't give about anything. Eat. Tomorrow there will be no talking. I didn't last for 2 days. I stopped. I couldn't take it. You know, it was too much. In 2007, again, I went on hunger strike. Then I spent from 2007 and 2010 on force feeding until things changed in the camp. And even Amy, our hunger strike was viewed by the camp administration as jihad. They said, we are Al-Qaeda cell and launching jihad against the United States. The way how they understood our protest and hunger strike. And we told them, this is our demand. You know, stop the torture, stop the interrogation, improve the living condition. And we need to figure out what's going to happen to us. So what they did, they used to also hide us when the ICRC came. I remember one day I was in force feeding. The ICRC, his name Hatim, Sudanese guy. He walked in the block and was like, in the force feeding, hey, I would call him Hatim. He looked at me and he covered his eyes. I said, what's wrong with you? He said, we are not allowed to see you in that way. Even the ICRC at Guantanamo, you know, we asked them to leave many years. We boycott them. We give them official letters. We signed many letters asking them to leave Guantanamo because being at Guantanamo as ICRC, it just gave legitimacy to whatever American do here.
We're talking to Mansour Daifi. He was detainee 441 at Guantanamo, in prison without charge for 14 years, and has written a memoir about his life, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. So I then want to ask you about what happened in 2016, why after 14 years without charge, in at 19 years old, now in your 30s, you were released, and how you ended up, a Yemeni man, in Serbia.
I was approved for release. Then I was sent to Serbia against my will. I refused to come to Serbia. I was forced. They told me, you have no choice, either leave or rot in here. Then the ICRC, when I protest, I went on hunger strike, protesting going to Serbia. The ICRC came, he told me, Mansour, they issued a new, Obama administration issued a new rules. If any detainee accepted by any country, he will be forced to leave regardless. So basically, I had no choice. They bought me with money, and they give the Serbian government money to take me again. So this is the game. We have no say.
And so you end up in Serbia. You end up in Belgrade. I was just listening to an interview that Frontline did with you. And when PBS partnered with NPR to do this documentary series, you did an interview with them, and ultimately you were beaten for that interview. Can you explain what happened to you, this not long after you got to Serbia?
You know, when they came to interview me, I was in hunger strike on my 25 days. I spent 48 days on hunger strike protesting my condition because the agreement between the United States government and the receiving countries, it was a resettlement agreement. But when we arrived at the hosting countries, they said, no, we had an agreement. We had a good contract to come here for 2 years. You live in our countries under restrictions, nothing. You have no education, no courses, no. You know, they made us promises, especially in my case, I was recommendation to finish my college education. So I talked to my lawyer. I said, I cannot live here. I cannot stay here. I want to leave. So I went on a hunger strike when I was even one of the universities. I was accepted when they found out I came from Guantanamo. I was expelled. You know, this is one of the things that hurt me most after Guantanamo. So I went on hunger strike. When the frontline came here, the first we had, they went to the government. They said they were fine and they weren't doing well. When they came to see me, I was in hunger strike. They were surprised. The first time we had an interview. Then the second day, some people came to my apartment, took me down. They won't send me a message. Stop lying. You're lying. You're a liar. You're a liar and so on, you know. And, you know, I don't want to cause any problem because I didn't want to expect. Because, as you know, the Serbian, they have their history with Bosnia in the 1990s. Scary place. So then I disappear. Then I contacted my lawyer. I contacted the frontline. We continue again. And again, after the interview was aired, the Serbian newspaper really presented me in the worst way. A newspaper, TV, I was arrested, interrogated, threatening to be entrapped. You know, I wrote a lot about it, and you read it here. I don't want to talk much detail because they're going to kick my ass again. But what I have learned at Guantanamo, I will never keep silence, you know, because keeping silence only gives the oppressor a mean to oppress you more. So I will never keep silence. I will, whatever they do, I will keep, you know, because I have done nothing wrong. Even if I have done something wrong, there is a justice system. You cannot just beat people, arrest them, or target them because you have a power. So basically, yes, I mean, then in 2018, they came to me. They said, now that 2 years finished, you have the choice to go to Saudi jail or to go to the refugee camp. And that guy, his name is Nicola, told me, American f***ed you. The interview cost you a lot, literally word by word. And my lawyer was there. Listen to him. You're like, what? So, yes, what I talk about our life after Guantanamo, we still live in Guantanamo 2.0. You know, just let you know, Amy, I studied in another college. I will be graduating the 29th of September. And my thesis is about rehabilitation and reintegration of former Guantanamo detainees into social life and the labor market. I have been doing a lot of research for the last 5 years. I have interviewed around 150 brothers released from Guantanamo.
You can't leave Serbia, Mansoor.
Do you remember when I told you the worst pain that touched your soul? You know, I wanted to get married. I found really a woman that I thought she is going to be my wife. The only thing was like the piece of paper and a travel document where I can get married. So I couldn't travel, so I couldn't marry and finish. Not just me. I think I'm lucky. There are one of the brothers, Lutfi, he died last year. He had heart diseases. He was relocated from Kazakhstan to Mauritania, where they didn't have good health system. He needed to go to somewhere where he can be treated because he needed emergency surgery. And his doctor told him, you have at least 6 months. So he needed $30,000 cash organized, raised fund for him. And they said his surgery will be covered. He needed just a travel document, either travel to Tunisia or their country, just to have the surgery and get back. He lost his life. You know, it's one of the saddest moments. Like when I was talking to him, Martin Case, we talked to the ICRC, we talked to our human rights organization, to government. Nobody cares. Simply nobody cares.
Former Guantanamo prisoner Mansoor Dyfi. When we come back, Mansoor will talk about how faith and art helped him survive Guantanamo, as well as why he insisted on having a woman voice the audiobook version of his new memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware.
Is it for freedom, Sarah Thompson, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Mansoor Dyfi, he was jailed by the United States at Guantanamo for 14 years. He's author of the new memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. I asked him about reports that the Biden administration was considering holding Haitian refugees at Guantanamo.
Creating another Guantanamo, you know, I hope, you know, Western nation, United States and the Western nation can solve the crisis within the countries, that generation, that massive crisis of refugees, immigration, and so on. Because dealing with the symptoms is not going to help. you know, they should help the countries to have some kind of stability so that people can live their life. Yeah, it's one of the biggest crises in the 21st century, the massive migration and refugees. So, but creating Guantanamo again, it brought us again, what's going to happen to these people? How's it going to be treated? So I hope, I tweeted about it, and I don't want anyone to be detained in that place, especially the name of Guantanamo. I love Guantanamo. I have made peace with it. But the idea of Guantanamo, you know?
Well, let me ask, when you said I have made peace with it, you held up your scarf that's orange, that's wrapped around your neck right now as you speak to us. You were forced to wear orange from head to toe. Why wear orange now?
I wear orange all the time. Because at Guantanamo, when the psychologists and the ICRC told me, wow, if you see the orange color, you'll say, you will be shocked. If you heard the known performer, I said, no, this is part of my life, and I will never let Guantanamo change me. So, alhamdulillah, I choose to fight for to close Guantanamo and to try to help anyone who wrongly detained or strip his his freedom, because I don't want anyone to suffer the same fate I have suffered. Although I have made peace with Guantanamo, I almost like every day talk about Guantanamo, write, talk, give interviews, and so on. My other brothers, they don't want to remember, because it's like a trauma. You traumatize yourself over and over again. But for me, I took it in another way, and alhamdulillah, I have some kind of strength. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave me strength. So I would use that strength to support those helpless people, and also to bring the truth about Guantanamo. So I use my 441 in my emails, in my names, everywhere. And I use the orange color all the time. It also to bring the awareness to the people, the misuse of power, how can damage us as humans.
Finally, if you can talk about how you survived through Guantanamo, what hope meant for you, and was it hope that kept you going through the forced feedings, through the hunger strikes, through the beatings, through the torture? What got you through?
First of all, Amy, faith as Muslims. The first thing, we stick to our faith as Muslims, because before Guantanamo, I was studying Islamic Institute. That where I get the mission to go for research. So most of us, you know, even the U.S. government viewed us as terrorists or the faith a source of terrorism. It's not. First, it's our faith, stick to it, praying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, knowing that everything in the hand of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and America has had nothing to decide our faith. Secondly, we had each other, because we were kept at that place. We had no books, nothing, just totally disconnected from the world outside. So we had only each other. I wrote about it. A piece called The Beautiful Guantanamo, which is, I just took all the bad things and I wrote about how we survived Guantanamo. Imagine, Amy, around 50 nationalities, 20 languages, different background. People who watched Guantanamo, they were artists, singers, doctors, nurses, divers, mafia, drug addicts, teachers, scholars, poets. That diversity of culture interacted with each other, melted, and formed what we call Guantanamo culture. We call it the beautiful Guantanamo. Imagine, I'm going to sing now, two songs, please. Imagine we used to celebrate once a week, night, and to escape away a pain of being in jail. Try to have some kind of to take our minds from being cages, torture, abuses. So we had one night a week, in the black. So we just start singing Arabic, English, Pashto, Urdu, Farsi, French, all kind of languages. Poets in different languages, stories, people dance from Yemen to Saudi Arabia, to rap, to all kind. It's like, imagine you hear in one block, 48 detainees, you heard those beautiful, you know, songs in different languages. It was captivating. They took that. However, the interrogators took it as a challenge. We didn't challenge them. We just tried to survive. This was a way of surviving, because we had to lead each other. the things we brought with us at Guantanamo, whether our faith, whether our knowledge, our memories, our emotions, our relationship, who we are, help us to survive. We had only each other. Also, the guard was part of our survival because they play a role in that, by helping some of them, help sometimes in singing with us sometimes. Also, we had the art classes. I think you heard about the especially in that time when we get access to classes, we paint. So those are the things help us to survive at that place. Hope also. Hope, it was a matter of life or death. You have to keep hoping. You know, that place was designed just to take the hope away so you can see the only hope is through the interrogators, through Americans. We said, no, it's not going to happen that way. So we had to support each other, try to stay alive. Also, we lost some brothers. And I lost very good brothers at that place. It's one of the, hardest and saddest moments at Guantanamo. And alhamdulillah, I managed. I don't know if I survived, to be honest with you, because someone asked me last month. I had an interview with the Someone asked me, how did you spend your 20s and 30s? I said, I don't know. I don't know what does it mean, 20s or 30s. I am now at my late of my 30s, but I'm not free yet. So imagine I have a huge gap in our life, like 15 years, I'm going to now 5 years now. And physically, technically, I feel like I'm 38, 39, but practically I feel like I'm still in my 20s, this mentality. You can see in my behavior, the way I talk, that's who I am actually. So there's a huge gap. And when I was released, different society, language, community, anyone and get interact or friend with get arrested, interrogated, people stay away from us. So because the stigma of Guantanamo. So basically, but I'm trying to make a life, get married. Yeah, I can sing a song for you.
Yes, you said you'd sing too.
Yeah, the first one when we like supporting, because especially when General Miller arrived, he tried to crush us. The first day he arrived, he searched all of us, beat all of us. Cavity search, they brought dogs, FC teams, pepper spray. It was like a message. I am here, those terrorists. I'm going to kick your asses. So, but at Guantanamo, we don't treat people with rank. It doesn't matter. The only thing we had with guard respect and for shit. This is simple as that. Not all of us, but a group of us. I'm sorry for these words, but we are talking about Guantanamo. So because Guantanamo was designed to extract the worst of us. So when someone would go to the interrogation or for torture, we try to support him, and we would sing for him. روح روح مع السلامة الله يزيدك أمن وسلامة روح روح مع السلامة الله يزيدك أمن وسلامة like around 40, 2 blocks sometimes sing together collectively. It was like give some encouraging.
And what did that mean? What did that mean?
He said, روح روح مع السلامة go with peace. May Allah grant you more peace and safety. And when they came from appointment or interrogation or torture, or people came arrive at Guantanamo, new at Guantanamo, especially when there's a new group arrive at Guantanamo, we would welcome them in that song. Imagine you just new arrive at Guantanamo, like 3 blocks, around 150 detainee song for you. Haba, haba, billija, billija, ya marhaba. باللي جاء باللي جاء حبا حبا باللي جاء باللي جاء يا مرحبا. It means welcome but the one who come. Imagine when the brothers first time arrived, you sing for them. They said, well, it was like they were surprised. Are they detainees or they're like living in kind of a beach like, or something? One of the brothers used to tell us, we thought that you guys live in some kind of lovely life and enjoying yourself. Then when they took the hood, whoa, it is cages. That's what they expect. He said, I heard the voice. I thought like everyone is happy singing. So we can give them the first impression that everything's okay.
Mansoor, last two questions. One is you talked about the art classes that you took. Can you describe what art meant for you and what did you create? What did you draw?
I mean, when we started negotiating with the Khan administration in 2010, we negotiated art class. The Khan commander said, art class? Your guy is tourist. You didn't have to paint. So we asked the brothers, can you paint, please? The second meeting, we showed them. They were shocked and surprised. They said, okay. It was a process, negotiation, asking over and over again. But alhamdulillah, you know, art class is one of the most important classes to go into now because it helps us to express ourselves. It was a mean way of escaping being in jail because you need to skip that feeling. So art connect us to the world outside. You can see the brothers, we paint, see trees. The things we missed most, sky, the stars, you know, homes, deserts, and so on. So arts actually help us to connect to our life that we almost forgot. The art connect us to ourselves because it brings that memories back. It connect us to each other. It connect us to the gods. You know, when someone saw arts, it kind of like mutual admiration and love and for arts. And some of the gods ask for the brothers to paint for them. They give them like arts for gifts. Brothers used to teach gods art. Same thing, gods who has background teach brothers. Also, we, you know, in the art, one of the brothers, Sabri, one of the artists in Khaled, I said, Khaled, how do you feel? He said, Mansour, wallahi, when I paint, I saw myself in that painting, like in the hill, on the boat, on the ship, on the sea, sometime like running here and there. So he said, like, it just takes my mind and calm people down. And, you know, it was like a therapy too. Also, one of the things we did there, we had like painting everywhere, ourselves in the block. We actually changed the blocks to be like a hotel. You know, you can see the rooms, the paintings, the art, the science, everything could change the life because we needed to change everything to live in different. We didn't intentionally, but this is the way how we want things to be.
Mansour, I wanted to ask you about your choice to have a woman voice your book. Usually it's the author when a book is done through audio that someone can listen to it. It's either the author or an actor. But you chose to have a woman read, voice, Don't Forget Us Here. Why?
Yeah, I remember when I was like talking to Sam from Hashtag. Hi, Sam, Antonio, and Julia, my agent. I said, guys, I need a woman. I want to read my book. No, why? It didn't happen before. You know, typically the man, I said, no, I want a woman to read my book. Monson, that doesn't make any sense. I said, what makes sense about going to him? Nothing makes sense. I told him, plus, you know, men have been kidnapped, they tortured me, kicked my ass, imprisoned me. And like, they have done a lot of things, you know. The one who treated us, you know, nicely was woman. So I went to woman to read my book. So why not? At the same time, I told him it is like kind of racism against women. So first they sent me some kind of like men. I said, no, I want a woman to read my book. So when they found it was turned out good, they said, wow, this is a good idea. I said, no, I told you.
Former Guantanamo prisoner Mansour Daifi, author of the new memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. He was speaking to us from Serbia. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astujo, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Mary Conlon. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Gran, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Stand with Wet'suwet'en. McGill University must divest from TC Energy. A community campus action on Wednesday, December 1st, taking place just inside the Milton Gates at James Square. With poetry, speeches, and music, McGill University invests over $4.7 million into TC Energy Corporation, the company that is building the Coastal GasLink pipeline on Indigenous Wet'suwet'en lands. Now is the time for McGill University to divest from TC Energy. Join us for a campus community action at 5:30 on Wednesday, December 1st. This event is co-hosted by Divest McGill the Indigenous Student Alliance, and is co-presented by CKUT Radio. See you there.
I'm Martin Carly, and I like to popularize science. Vaccination against COVID-19 for children aged 5 to 11 has begun. As parents, you may be asking if your child will receive the same vaccine as adults. The vaccine used for children younger than 12 years old contains a smaller amount of mRNA because children's immune systems respond better than those of adults. And even though they're given small